It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about good old-fashioned Midwestern home cooking. And later this hour, a woman who has been sharing recipes with readers and radio listeners for more than 60 years is going to be here, Iowa's best-known homemaker, Evelyn Berkmey. And joining me right now is someone who hasn't been sharing recipes with her readers and listeners for quite that long, but still has quite a following. Lynn Rosetto Casper is here, host of The Splendid Table from American Public Media and author of many books, including How to Eat Weekends. Hello, Lynn.
Hello, Charity. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for coming back to the show. And this hour, I want to talk about Midwestern home cooking, and we're going to start with the evolution of Midwestern food. But I also want to make sure that you know you can join our conversation this hour. We want to hear about the favorite dish that you learned to make from your grandmother, or the thing that you wish you'd learned to make from your grandmother or your grandfather. 866-780-9100 is the number to call to join the conversation. 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Lynn, when I think about how the settlers came to the Midwestern United States, they came from all over the world. And of course, there are the Germans and the Norwegians and the Swedes and people coming from everywhere to this part of the world. And there were people, of course, well known for making their own traditional foods, but how did all of those different traditions start to evolve into what we know as Midwestern food?
Well, it's a great question, because that kind of evolution is always much more complicated than it seems on the surface. And I think this is the thing about, you know, the proverbial melting pot concept of what we are as a nation. We are a melting pot. We end up sharing each other's food traditions, because your family may have immigrated from Germany and my family may have immigrated from Italy, and they lived next door to each other and they were just starting out and their kids played together and they'd say, let's get together and, you know, come to the house for dinner, and you're tasting something you've never tasted before. And you're saying, how do you make that? And someone's, you know, your host says, hey, this is how I do it. Let me show you. Come over tomorrow afternoon. And before you know it, your German grandmother is making the pasta that my Italian grandmother made. But what ends up happening is two sort of seemingly opposed things. Number one, the immigrant, or the person that's come from somewhere else, it's not a case of coming from another country. I mean, I moved from New York City to Denver, Colorado, and boy, did I hold on to the things I knew and loved in New York. You know, it was one of those things where it's part of my identity. But so it's that holding on to the tradition. It's part of who we are, holding on to those foods. But by the same token, it's what happened between our grandparents or our great-grandparents. It's that idea of, well, I've got bratwurst. I don't have Italian sausage. So I'll put that into the pot with the tomato sauce. And why don't I serve this over spätzle instead of over spaghetti? And it's that kind of thing that starts to evolve. And a lot of my colleagues, you know, authentic is a really tricky word, because you have to raise a lot of questions when you talk about authentic. Can anything be authentic once it's left its sort of mother location, because the whole everything changes, you know, what's available, how people react to it, etc. But you know a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues will say, well, you know, that's food, that's just it's meaningless. No, it isn't. It's who we are. and you go to a fancy restaurant today and you will find a French inspired dish, but it's done with Thai ingredients. It's the exact same thing that's evolved in the Midwest. We've shared all of these things that we grew up with, that our ancestors brought with us. And then, of course, it's what we have available. I mean, nowhere in the country is there pork and corn quite like what is growing right outside of Des Moines. This is, you folks are the breadbasket or the heartland for that, for those two crops and many other things as well. And that all influences it. So,
and I can imagine that scarcity also influenced a lot of the evolution of food as well, because I'm sure that a lot of these immigrants from Germany and Ireland and Italy had never made cornbread before they were out on the plains of the Midwest.
I mean, you, sir, I can remember we moved to Belgium and I found one farmer who was growing sweet corn and I served corn on the cob in the summer to some of our new Belgian friends. And they kind of, they were polite, but they thought they were eating cow food. So, yes, scarcity and weather. Look at the weather. I mean, what do you live on once it's October and before it's, you know, June or July? So you have what can you store away? So, yes, all of that figured into how we eat. So when people talk about hot dish, you know, and the whole idea behind it of, you know, the canned soup and whatever you have in the house, the frozen vegetables, well, that's about convenience foods. But if you roll that idea back to the casserole you took to the church supper in the 1800s, it was coming from the root cellar.
Absolutely.
And it was what you put up in the summer that you then, you know, you poured the tomatoes or the stewed tomatoes over the root vegetables and the ham because you had slaughtered the pig and you had cured it. And you wanted to stretch that meat as far as you could. And when you baked it in a casserole with all that good stuff, well, that's how you fed a crowd, fed them well, and you didn't necessarily break the bank.
I can imagine that there are different kinds of scarcity, too, because, of course, people needed to get by with what they could produce on their own farms for a long time. But again, we went through a big period of scarcity in World War II, and that was a very different kind of scarcity. And that must have changed our food as well.
I think it did, absolutely, because that was a case where everybody was trying to have victory gardens. And being in a farming area, I think in some ways it had to have been a bit easier because you did have access to land. You could grow some of your own food. And the other thing is that you already had a background of how to preserve and how to store and how to husband. I wonder, and I'm not sure because I don't come from a farming family, but I wonder when it comes to scarcity and it comes to deprivation, if people with a farming heritage aren't really ahead of the game because generally, farmers know that in any decade, you're going to have a couple of really good years for crops, and then you're going to probably have some years that are kind of middling, and you're going to have some years that are really lousy. And you're used to planning for that. You're used to saving, to husbanding, to being very careful and very frugal. And I think that got people through hard times much more easily. But during World War II, what? You weren't going to use fats, right? Because they were going into the war effort. There were so many other things that were really rationed or limited. And you had to generally manage with what you could grow yourself and those books, those ration books that allowed you, you know, X amount of fat or X amount of meat every month. And it was a different kind of living. And it was also, I think, priming people for the idea of perhaps having convenience foods. Because I think it was getting harder and harder to feed a family the things they were used to eating. And at the end of the war, supposedly, a lot of the foods that were created for the men and the women in the trenches, you know, the things where you added water and you had a cake, there was a surplus of that, supposedly, from our food industry. And that was the beginning of some of those prepared foods in the mixes.
Well, and I can imagine that a lot of our grandmothers and great-grandmothers would have a hard time believing that we're nostalgic for the foods that they put together when they were just trying to get by.
Yes, exactly. And yet, you know, we don't know what those foods would have tasted like today unless we're lucky enough to have some of those people still in our lives. But I think this idea, it makes me crazy when I hear people say, well, you know, there was nothing to eat in America before 1970. The food was just barbaric. And it's like, oh, get a grip. I mean, we've had great food in this country since day one. Native Americans had cuisines and still have cuisines that are phenomenal. You know, we've always had good food and we've always figured out how to get by and do it brilliantly. So I don't have a lot of patience with this idea that everybody, you know, was eating terrible food and just dying for a McDonald's hamburger.
I'm talking with Lynn Rossetto Casper. She is, of course, the host of The Splendid Table from American Public Media, the host or the author of many books, including How to Eat Weekends. And we want you to join the conversation as well this hour. We're talking about good old-fashioned Midwestern home cooking. We want to know what you're nostalgic for, what great dishes have been passed down through your family at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Katie's on the line from Urbandale. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I had a question for you. When my grandmother had this famous goulash recipe, and she never wrote anything down except for some of her bakery things. So unfortunately, she passed away without handing that down to any of us. She was born Czech, and my grandfather was 100% German. I don't know if that helps at all. But I just wanted to see if you had any ideas of what the basis of those might have been, you know, starting in like the 40s, I would say, is probably when she started making that.
Goulash was a big thing all through the Depression. Well, really, it was a big thing all through the 1900s and even the 1800s, but goulash also was often what you did with
right.
whatever you had. But let me ask you, what did it taste like and what did it look like? Was it reddish colored? Was there paprika in it?
Yes, there definitely was paprika in it.
Was it spicy?
A little, yes.
Did it have any kind of bacon flavor in it or pork fat, like fatback or salt
pork? Not that I remember, but she passed away when I was about 7, so that's probably the last time that had it.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
So my father is
made...
trying to get me to recreate this for him.
do you think it was pork or beef, or was it just
I'm
whatever
guessing
she
it was
had?
Probably pork.
Okay, because this is what I'm thinking. I mean, a true goulash, a traditional goulash, not true, because goulash takes a lot of forms, is this wonderful, it's this idea of you start out with something like a salt pork or salt pork that you might boil first to get rid of some of the salt, or you could use bacon and get a nice smoky backdrop. But the idea was that you would sauté that, chunks of that, you know, cut up into cubes, with onion, with a bit of green pepper, perhaps later on adding garlic to that, and then you would stir in paprika. Now, in the 40s, you would probably not be easily getting Hungarian paprika, you know, which has a lot of sweetness and a lot of character, and you can find that today, and you can also just find you can also find delicious tasting paprikas now in specialty stores and supermarkets, you know, from Spain and whatever. But the point is, you want a generous amount of paprika. If you want a little spice, you would throw in some hot pepper. So it might be cayenne, it might be pepper flakes. But you really want that chopped onion and that green pepper and that garlic and that bacon to be the foundation. And then what you do is you brown meat. Brown it separately. Brown it in a little bit of that fat from the pork, or if you want to, brown it even in an oil. And you want to get it really nice size chunks, like 1.5, 2-inch chunks of pork shoulder. And you want to get it really nice and brown on all sides. Don't let the pieces touch. Throw that into the pot. Add a bit of tomato, okay, like, oh, if you have 2 pounds of meat, you might want, or 3 pounds of meat, you might want like a 14-ounce can of whole tomatoes that you crush with your hands, and maybe a bit of broth, okay? And you let that simmer very slowly, barely bubbling, until it's nice and tender, probably 1.5 hours, maybe 2 hours. Don't overcook it, though, because then the meat loses all its flavor. But that would be your beginning for goulash. And then from there, you know, you can take off in any direction you want to go. You can add cloves, you can add bay leaves, you could try it out with, you know, some fancy paprika from Hungary or, you know, a very sweet California paprika. So that's where you begin, though.
Well, good luck with that, Katie. And Lynn, I have to say that having grown up in Iowa, I was probably well into my 20s before I realized that goulash didn't always have elbow macaroni in it. But We can talk.
There is nothing wrong with elbow macaroni.
No. Oh, it's delicious. It's absolutely delicious. We're going to take a short break here. I'm talking with Lynn Rosetto Casper. She's the host of The Splendid Table from American Public Media, author of many books, including How to Eat Weekends. We're talking about good old-fashioned Midwestern home cooking. And in just a few minutes, Iowa's most famous homemaker, Evelyn Berkby, is going to join our conversation as well. And we want to hear from you. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about good old-fashioned Midwestern home cooking. And with me is Lynn Rosetto Casper, host of The Splendid Table from American Public Media and author of many cookbooks, including How to Eat Weekends. And joining us now on the line is Evelyn Berkby, Iowa's best-known homemaker. She was on KMA Radio's Kitchen Clatter program for many, many years. She's still on KMA Radio every week. She's also a weekly columnist for the Shenandoah Evening Sentinel and the author of many books, including, most recently, Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living from Iowa's Best Known Homemaker. Evelyn Berkby, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Charity. This is such a delight for me.
Well, I'm so glad to have you back on the show. And Lynn and I have been talking about the evolution of Midwestern cooking. And, of course, you have been sharing these recipes for many, many, many years with your readers and with your listeners. But I know that one of the things that you feel is most important for everyone to think about right now is that everybody needs to learn to cook.
Yes, yes. When I found out I was going to raise three boys, I said to them, you're my helpers. You're going to learn how to do all the things that need to be done in the home, including cooking. And I even taught them to make bread. And do they impress their contemporaries when they go to, and they do. Young people have a lot of gatherings where everybody brings food. We call it potlucks back here in Iowa. And that's what I was raised on. But my boys take this good food that they learn to make here at home. And I also feel that men are wonderful chefs, and they don't need to just go and do fancy, fancy things. They can do ordinary meals out of their own kitchens.
Well, Evelyn, maybe you understood how important it was to teach your children to cook, partially because I believe you didn't learn how to cook when you were growing up.
Well, my mother was one of these pinch and touch and smell, and she didn't use very many recipes. And that kind of a cook is not a good teacher. Finally, she gave me a cookbook, and she said, you've got to teach yourself. And would you believe I began with yeast bread? That was the first recipe I made. And I love making bread. I still make it every week. And now it's hearty whole wheat bread. But it was fun once I really began to learn. But the thing that really frightened me when I started writing my newspaper column, and that was 63 years ago, and my publisher said, always put in a recipe. That's where the press got this title for my latest book, Always Put in a Recipe, and Other Tips for Living. It's a collection of my columns is what it is. But I did not tell him I didn't know how to cook. But what I did was throw myself on the mercy of my farm wife neighbors. I wasn't a very good farm wife. Never was a very good farm wife. I had trouble learning how to do the things that farm wives are supposed to do. I never did learn to garden. Thank goodness Robert is a very good gardener. My husband still is a very good gardener.
Well,
and then I learned to can. That was my contribution.
Very, very useful contribution. Lynn, listening to Evelyn talk about her mother being one of those cooks that could just cook and never needed to look at a recipe, who did you learn to cook from?
Well, you know, like Evelyn, my mother, and Evelyn, by the way, it's so great to finally meet you. because I've been hearing about you for a long time.
Well, and I know about you, too, so thank you.
Well, you're the pioneer. I mean, you were doing this long before I did, and congratulations on it because, you know, food on the radio, everybody thinks we're crazy, but we're not. No, go ahead, please.
Well, no, I was just finishing the sentence in a way that my neighbors and my friends and my radio listeners and my writers helped teach me to cook. And the best thing I ever did was to tell them I didn't know how and I needed them. And they loved it. And I'm sure that you have listeners that give you their hints and their helps.
Absolutely. And my mother was like your mother. She loved to cook. She was a really good cook, but she wasn't a teacher at all. And it was very much, she really followed a recipe. I discovered that after she passed away, an old, old, old copy of The Joy of Cooking. Mm. And I think that was the only cookbook she owned. Now, but, you know, obviously being an Italian family, a lot of what she made was Italian, although she loved trying out other things. But I started cooking kind of by feel. And when I think of the horrific things that I made when I was 15 and 16, I'm just amazed that the family survived because, and you know, they're the kind of things that today they could blackmail you, you know, if anybody knew about them. I think like you, it was a case of I was really curious and I was hungry. I really was curious about flavors and I was hungry. And my father passed away when I was in my teens and my mother worked and my grandmother lived with us, but she wasn't well. So my mother always had food in the house, obviously, but I wanted to try things. And I wanted to try new things. And it's very funny because the very first thing I ever did professionally was teach Chinese cooking. You know, a kid from Paramus.
Oh, my.
Yeah, Chinese cooking, right, from Paramus, New Jersey, Italian-American. Now, granted, you know, I was living outside of New York, so I had a little experience. But, can you imagine?
Well, that's a wonderful story.
We have some people who want to get involved in this conversation, and you're welcome to join us as well at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And in particular, we want to know what dishes have been passed down through your family. What things are you nostalgic for? We've already talked about goulash, and now Kate is on the line from Lacona. Hello, Kate.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, when you were talking about the Depression and World War II and people adapting their recipes for restricted ingredients, I just last week made my grandmother's recipe of poor man's cake. And it's a cake, it's like a spice cake, and it doesn't have any eggs, and it uses shortening or lard, and basically it had raisins that you boil and get them kind of softened up, mushed up, and that kind of added a little bit of fluffiness to the cake. But it's a delicious spice cake, and I've been eating it all my life and cooking it for many years, and I just wanted to share that, you know, she learned how to make a lot of different things with what she had at hand.
And apparently she did very well.
Yeah.
Well, I never liked cooking until I became an adult, and I hate processed foods worse than I hate cooking. So I learned how to cook. And now the new thing in Iowa is I'm raising meat goats, and I'm looking for some recipes because talking to people about goat meat in Iowa elicits a whole lot of interesting reactions.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
But Evelyn, don't you think as far as goat recipes, if it's made with lamb, it can be done with goat? In fact, beef as well?
Oh, of course. You can juggle meat and the same way with goulash. I love that discussion because I think goulash is one of these things that you can make in many different ways. And as you said, kind of with what was left over. And the people who lived through depressions learned how to do with what they had on hand. My father was a minister, and this was in a period of time when they didn't make a great deal, but people brought in food. If they had a lot of green beans or many, many tomatoes, or when they butchered, they would bring in some good, good food off of the farm. So I always thought we ate pretty well, lots of fried chicken and many, many potluck dinners at the church. I love potluck dinners to this day because you do get a sampling of what everybody enjoys making, and I've learned most of my good recipes from potluck dinners, too, that are my favorites. And one of the things that interests me is how many cooking shows there are on television now. And it's become popular again to cook in your own kitchen. And I like that. But I love homegrown foods. I learned at my grandmother's knee how to make homemade butter. And it was so good. Made with that country cream. And then I would go out to my aunt and uncles where they raised everything on their farm. And I thought that was the best food in the world. And I didn't know how much work it was until I lived on a farm myself. And then I discovered I made homemade butter. We had 11 cows we milked. The smartest thing I ever did was not learn to milk. Yeah, I thought I was too stupid, but now I've decided that was a smart move. But I did the separating. And then I cooked with all that good country cream. And then I would make cottage cheese. My recipe for cottage cheese, you know what it is, Charity. It begins, go out and milk the cow. And then you clabber that milk and you make your own farm cottage cheese, and nothing tastes as good as that in the cottage cheese genre.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And then, you know, this wonderful low-calorie food that you just made, you pour that thick country cream over it when you serve it.
Well, and Evelyn, you've lived to be 93, so clearly it didn't do you too much harm.
Well, you know, I'm like Julia Childs. If it tastes good, I eat it. And I'm not going to die young, so let's go for it. And I still enjoy cooking. I still enjoy all the good country foods. And I like things at the farmer's market that we don't grow for ourselves anymore. And we do try to buy locally. And you can get that good taste, and nothing tastes like runaround chickens. You know, the farm,
right.
Free-range chickens, they're you're not
and their eggs,
like,
too, Evelyn. Their eggs are better, too, when they actually get to get out there and exercise. Lynn, I want to return to what Kate was talking about with her poor man's cake that her grandma made. And I heard an interview a couple of weeks ago on your show with a vegan chef, Doran Peterson, in Washington, D.C.,
yep.
And she was
right.
talking about how she has a vegan cupcakes and all of this stuff. She said that when she went back to find these recipes for vegan food, she didn't start out trying to take recipes that were not vegan and make them vegan. She went back and found all these Depression era recipes. And she said that the bakers, the cooks then were so inventive that a lot of those recipes were just fantastic.
Well, that's the thing. And what's so interesting is we look at these recipes today and we laugh. Tomato soup cake, the spice cake, Coca-Cola cake. The idea was that you would use something that had the right kind of texture and moisture that would substitute for eggs and butter, and because eggs and butter weren't available. And if you look at old cookbooks, there's a raft of these. And they are fabulous. And it's, you know, that business about what she said was so true. Every time someone says to me, well, I can't do dairy. How can I then have beef stroganoff? Well, you know, maybe you don't want beef stroganoff, but why don't you look at recipes or at cuisines or traditions that don't have anything to do with dairy? So my mind is you go to Asia in your head, you know, or you go places where there just isn't a lot of dairy used. But you start looking through all those old cookbooks and you will find these incredible baked goods that were made through the Depression, through World War II. If you haven't had a tomato soup cake, let me tell you, you haven't lived. And you know what? If you think about it, remember the whole deal about using a prune puree in brownies instead of using fat? you know, or applesauce in a cake instead of using fat. That's all the same idea. It's that same idea. So go backwards. You know, forwards is lovely, but go backwards because people like Evelyn and a lot of other people have always had the cleverness to find a way to make delicious food without using whatever ingredients weren't available. We now want to maybe approach it from a different point of view. We maybe don't want the gluten, but the reality is you're also going to save money.
We have KR on the line with us from Monticello. Hello, KR.
Good morning to you.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, for years I have looked at the old-time church cookbooks and things like that, and they have almost no herbs or spices, especially in their savory dishes. But I know that the European traditions they came from had those herbs and spices. When did those go away and how? Was it pioneer deprivation? Was it a fashion at some point?
Well, Evelyn, I'd love to know your take. My thought is it was very hard to get for people. You know, those herbs and spices were often very expensive. They may have been, by the time they would get shipped out to, you know, away from the coasts, they might be stale and not very good. And so they gradually began to disappear. And then as shipping and transport got better, you start to see them reappearing. But Evelyn, what do you think?
Well, my ancestors came from Scotland. They came over to Eastern Illinois in 1822. And then they raised everything that they ate. And so spices would not have been there. They just would not. And what you're saying is exactly right. They were not available. They raised every bit of their food during those pioneer years. I don't think that it's part of the tradition of many families. And maybe I don't use a whole lot of spices. I don't use a whole lot of garlic, although I think that's good for you. But things like that that are highly spiced just were not part of my growing up. But getting back to, I'm sorry, you need to talk to him.
Oh, you know, we were joking before the show this morning about putting three radio hosts on together. So,
yeah, right.
Yes. Right. You're very great, Charity.
Oh, this could be a recipe for insanity.
Right. Fun.
Right. KR, thank you so much for your call. We have some wonderful emails as well. This is from Jana in Nevada. She says, I started cooking early this morning, making a traditional family recipe for ham and bean soup, and listening to this program reminded me of watching my grandmother and father making the soup when I was a small child.
I have
tweaked the family recipe over the years, but the meal of bean soup and cornbread is a family comfort food favorite. We also have this from Beth in Osceola. She says, I found a recipe for chicken tetrazzini in a Betty Crocker 1965 cookbook, Dinner in a Dish. This became a favorite for family and potlucks. It's traveled with children and grandchildren to Texas, Kentucky, Arkansas, Nebraska, Costa Rica, Venezuela, Thailand, and the United Arab Emirates. We've changed it to use homemade chicken stock, fresh mushrooms, and roasted chicken rather than can. And then she says, my mother listened daily to Kitchen Clatter, received the newsletter and used the recipes, and I listened to Lynn Rosetto Casper every Saturday. So I guess we're from one generation to the next. And Evelyn, what are some of your favorite dishes? What do you like to cook?
Oh, well, the soup beans and with the ham hock and the cornbread. In fact, my son Craig and my granddaughter are coming tomorrow, and I always fix that. That menu when they come on the airplane because it holds, you know, you can cook it early. And I am a pressure cooker person. I got a pressure cooker all those years ago when we were married, and I learned to cook with it, and I love cooking my beans in 20 minutes on top of the stove. So I do mention that the favorite recipes I make are in the pressure cooker because you can save the energy and time, and I think the flavor's better. But back to your question, if I had a favorite, I love fried cornmeal mush with eggs, and some people have it with syrup and homemade syrup. I love making my own homemade syrup. And I like my own cornmeal. Oh, and the bottom line, to answer your question, white sauce. I never met a vegetable I didn't like to put in white sauce. And, of course, they've got a very fancy name for it now. And I can't pronounce it, so I'm not even going to say it. You ladies probably can. It's like cornmeal. When they have cooked cornmeal now, it's polenta. You know, they have fancy names for some of these very, very ordinary foods. So I like to cream chicken on toast. I make eggs au goldenrod, where you make a white sauce, and then you cut up the white of a boiled egg in it, and then you sprinkle the yolks on top after you've put it on toast. That was one of my mother's favorites, egg au goldenrod. And I love the fresh peas and potatoes in the spring with white sauce. Oh, and cream cabbage.
Evelyn, you're making me so hungry. And, you know, Lynn, we always hear you on the Splendid Table talking about so many different kinds of dishes. What do you like to cook yourself on just a normal Wednesday night?
I'm like Evelyn. I'm a bean girl. And what I do is, over the weekend, often I will do a batch of beans. And I collect beans. There's this very odd sort of piles of things in the pantry area we have. You know, they're all in glass jars. But every bean known to man has passed through our house at one point or another, I think. But what I love to do is I do the beans. And what I usually do is I saute some celery, carrot, and onion, and garlic, and just a little bit of olive oil. This is the Italian thing, you know. But I do that. And then I add the soaked beans and some water. And then I cook my beans. And then I'll freeze them. So I can pull out and I can throw together a multi-bean soup with a lot of vegetables in it, or I can take those beans and I can make sort of a spicy sauce in whatever style I want and then stir the cooked beans into it. And that takes 15, 20 minutes at most. That with some rustic bread, you know, a whole grain bread, cornbread, I just love. The problem with cornbread is I always eat it all before it gets to the table. So I try to avoid doing homemade cornbread. You know, it's so delicious. But the point is that that will be dinner. And because, you know, between that whole grain bread and the beans, you've got a complete protein. But it's delicious at the same time. And it's so filling. And people just love it.
Well, it breaks my heart to say this, but we are out of time. Lynn Rosetto Casper, thank you so much for being here today.
You are welcome. It's been a great pleasure.
Lynn Rosetto Casper, host of The Splendid Table from American Public Media and author of many books, including How to Eat Weekends. And Evelyn Berkby, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was a delight.
We'll come up with an excuse to do it again soon. Evelyn Berkby, Iowa's most famous homemaker. Her most recent book is Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living from Iowa's Best Known Homemaker. This is Talk of Iowa.